Hey everyone, Eric here. We're really excited about a new AI show from Turpentine called Autopilot, hosted by Will Summerlin. This podcast explores the adoption and rollout of AI in the industries that drive the economy, and the dynamic tech founders bringing rapid, scalable change to slow-moving industries. From law, to hardware, to aviation, Will interviews founders backed by Benchmark, Greylock, YC, and more to learn how they're automating at the frontiers in entrenched industries. Click on the link in the description to subscribe to Autopilot.
The right time to launch a feature or launch a product is right before it seems possible. If Google, with its infinite resources, with the largest email user base in the world, if they're not willing to invest and try to figure out what the future of email is, maybe I need to do something about this. We realize that, holy crap, for the entire history of email clients, the data in that email has been completely inaccessible. You can do like basic searches and stuff, but if you want to ask a question and have the email client figure out the answer for you, there was really no way to do that. But suddenly, this like giant corpus of unstructured text that everyone has, like gigabytes and gigabytes, is suddenly has gone from like this pile that's eating up disk space to like maybe something that's really valuable to you.
Today, my guest is Andrew Lee, founder of Shortwave, an AI-powered email app that describes itself as the smartest email app on planet Earth. Like many of us, I've been using Gmail for roughly 20 years now. And while I've tried several alternative email clients over time, for me, none have really stuck. Shortwave, however, has truly impressed me, and I've continued to use it past the point of curiosity and into the realm of forming a genuinely new and likely lasting habit. My favorite feature by far is the AI Assistant, which presents in the increasingly familiar form factor of the natural language sidebar chatbot. It can help you search through and configure your inbox, check your availability and schedule meetings, and refer to similar emails you've sent in the past so that it can imitate your style when drafting responses for you. As someone who's long since given up on Inbox Zero and really just wants an AI assistant to help me navigate my overloaded inbox, I can definitely say that I've had a few magical experiences with this product. The time saved in searching for things that I know exist but can't quite remember the keywords for, unto itself, has been delightful. Andrew, who previously founded Firebase and has already been acquired by Google once, was extremely open about the technology underlying Shortwave, reflecting the fact that this is no thin wrapper startup. And I had a ton of fun getting so deep into the details. We covered Shortwave's RAG stack, which is powered by a full download and re-indexing of your entire inbox, a process that takes hours and costs Shortwave real money, but which creates a remarkably responsive experience downstream. We also got into how the AI assistant works, from user message input to AI response, including tool selection, query reformulation, feature extraction, retrieval, re-ranking, and finally, answer generation. We also got into which models Shortwave is using, which include Mistral, fine-tuned GPT 3.5 turbos, and GPT 4 turbo, a list which is always subject to change, and right now, perhaps even more so than usual, since Claude 3 was just launched after we recorded, and long context Gemini 1.5 is on the horizon as well. Toward the end, we discussed how Andrew thinks about building and timing product launches in such a fast-moving space, his vision for the future of Shortwave, how he expects email to evolve, and how we'll all manage the inevitable rise of high-quality AI-generated spam, as well as how companies will use a deep AI integration to manage knowledge on a team-wide basis. If you're building with large language models, this conversation has a ton of great nuggets which you won't want to miss. And if you're just an average email user, as I'm pretty sure all of you are, I definitely recommend checking out Shortwave. To be clear, this is not a paid promotion. Andrew was kind enough to give me a free year of Shortwave, but that's it. I'm genuinely just super enthusiastic about this product. And you do have my commitment that I will always be transparent about any sponsorship deals that we might do in the future. As always, we appreciate it when folks share the Cognitive Revolution with friends. And right now, in particular, as we're ramping up the new feed, a social media share would be especially valuable. Of course, your feedback is always welcome too. You can leave me a message on our new website at cognitiverevolution.ai. That's cognitiverevolution.ai, or DM me on the social media platform of your choice. Now, let's dive deep into AI technology powering the future of email with Andrew Lee of Shortwave. Andrew Lee, founder of Shortwave, welcome to the Cognitive Revolution.
Thank you for having me here, Nathan. Really excited.
I am very excited about this one. So I have been using your product, Shortwave, which is an email app, over the last couple weeks getting ready for this episode. And it is one that has really kind of got me excited for multiple reasons. So I'll just give you a little gushing praise right out of the gate. And then I really want to get into all the weeds of how it works. Like many people, I've been using Gmail for a long time. I hesitate to kind of count up all the years at this point, but it's getting on toward 20. And a lot of alternative interfaces have come out, a lot of, you know, ways to get to inbox zero. And honestly, none of those have really ever stuck with me, though I have tried a number over time. Shortwave has really stood out to me for a couple of things. One, the email search is awesome. And for that alone, I think it's, you know, pretty exciting. And then second, the AI assistant, which is actually how I'm using search, which we can unpack in more detail. But the AI assistant is perhaps the best writing as me experience that I have encountered in any app that I've used so far. So it has actually been, you know, while I kind of signed up for everything and, you know, we'll put some time into trying all the products, you know, that we talk about on the podcast, this is one that I have found myself very naturally kind of excitedly going back to. And, you know, the muscle memory of going straight to Gmail is certainly pretty deeply entrenched. So that is no small accomplishment. I think it's reflective of some really great work under the hood. Great job by you and the team. And with that, I'm excited to unpack in lots more detail how it all works.
That is awesome to hear. Thank you so much.
Maybe for starters, just to take one quick step back, like many application developers that we talk to, you started this company before large language models were a thing in the way that they are today. Would you want to give us just a little bit of context for what it was that kind of inspired you to start the company, how big of a part of your plan AI was at the time, and kind of how the technology trajectory that we're on has perhaps, you know, either been what you expected or perhaps surprised you?
Yeah, absolutely. AI was not really on the radar at all for us when we first started the company. The actual motivation for it really was a couple of things that happened in 2019. So for some background, I was unemployed at the time. I had previously sold a company, Firebase, to Google and worked there for a while. I'd taken some time off and I was kind of doing my own thing. And I got to the point where I was a little restless. I wanted to start something new. And I saw a couple of things happen. So the first thing that happened was the democracy protests in Hong Kong. I don't know if you remember. The thing that stood out to me was the way the Chinese government was using WeChat as a means of control of those protesters, where if you said something they didn't like, you know, maybe somebody would show up at your house or maybe they wouldn't get the message. And I looked at that and I said, hey, that's a bad thing. But at least that's not happening in other parts of the world, right? Everywhere else, you know, those centralized communication providers, they're trustworthy, they're doing a good job. And then I started to realize that actually, maybe that's not happening the way I was hoping in other parts of the world too, including potentially in the US and in Europe and places like that. And then I said to myself, well, at least we have email, right? Even if I don't necessarily want to do all my communication on, you know, WhatsApp or something like that, I can fall back to email. And then Google killed off Google Inbox, which to me was, you know, their next gen email product. And I thought to myself, hey, if Google, with its infinite resources, with the largest email user base in the world, if they're not willing to invest and try to figure out what the future of email is, you know, maybe I need to do something about this. And I have a long history with email. Actually, my dad and I ran an ISP in our basement in the 90s. And, you know, I have a lot of experience running email servers. And I have a love for the federated protocol that underpins email and all the things that enables. And I said, okay, you know what? Maybe I got to do something. So I call up a bunch of my Firebase buddies and I said, hey, you guys want to start another company? I'm thinking we should build an email app. And surprise, surprise, they were excited about it too. And so we kicked it off at the beginning of 2020, initially really focused on making something that did justice to this amazing underlying email protocol. And the first thing we tried to do was collaboration, because Firebase was a product really designed to help people build collaborative apps. We knew a lot about what people liked in collaboration. We knew a lot about how to build those types of systems, and we thought email was right for that. So we built an email client designed to help you collaborate, and fairly quickly discovered that that was kind of hopeless as a V1 product for go-to-market reasons. Like you couldn't sell to anyone because the people who were looking for email clients were not simultaneously looking to get off of Slack. And the people who were looking for Slack were not simultaneously wanting to pitch their entire team on not using their existing email client and switching to a new email client. And so we could never get someone who was like looking for booking at the same time. And so at that point, we pivoted and we said, hey, we are getting some traction on just the pure like individual email experience. Let's double down there. Let's really make just a really bang up individual business email client. And so we spent the next year and a half or so working on that, which is a big project. If you ever tried to build an email client, there's a lot of stuff in there, just lots of little features and just the basics of like displaying your email correctly and threading your email correctly, making search work is quite hard. But we got there like about a year and a half ago. We got to the point where like we had a solid email client. It did all the things you expected. It worked on the platforms you needed to work on. You know, it had the core features that you'd expect it to have. And we started looking around and realizing, hey, there's a lot of stuff going on here with these large language models. And, you know, we'd been following it for a while, but every time we'd played with them previously, they didn't quite seem production ready. And this time they did. This time, you know, we tried some stuff. Actually, one of my old co-founder came in and like demoed some stuff. And we decided, actually, we feel like the time is right. This is actually something that we can build a real product on. And the thing that was so exciting for us is we realized that, holy crap, for the entire history of email clients, the data in that email has been completely inaccessible really to the computer. You can do like basic searches and stuff, but if you want to ask a question and have the email client figure out the answer for you, there was really no way to do that. You could search, you could read yourself, but suddenly this like giant corpus of unstructured text that everyone has, like gigabytes and gigabytes and gigabytes of this, has gone from like this pile that's eating up disk space to like maybe something that's really valuable to you. So like at that point, we tested some stuff. It worked well and we pivoted hard. And like the last year and a half, we have been focused on AI.
The AI email assistant has been my favorite feature by far. And, you know, just to kind of describe it, and you can, you know, give me a little, refine my description, but it basically exists as a side panel on the, and as kind of like a popover on the mobile app, which you also have, although I've spent more time so far with the desktop version. But I can kind of bring up a side panel that's alongside my main inbox. And then I can basically just have a ChatGPT like experience with that assistant, you know, in a chat back and forth, natural language sort of way. But with the difference that obviously it is connected into all of my emails. So it can do searches against that email. It can pull up relevant examples. And then it can also connect to my calendar. And then it can even start to draft responses for me. Feel free to kind of elaborate on how you would typically pitch the or describe the product experience. And then I really want to get into, you know, the weeds of how have you set up the agent architecture? You know, what is the, obviously being a database guru, like what is the RAG implementation look like? And, you know, how are you actually bringing about such good results in the write as me department? Those are kind of the three big areas. But for starters, you know, you can refine my description.
I think the thing that really impress us about LLMs is how general purpose they are. Like you can go into ChatGPT and you can talk about just about anything. Like last night I made fried chicken sandwiches and like I got it to explain to me how to make a fried chicken sandwich. And today I'm like asking it coding questions. And it could do all this stuff, which is really cool. And so one of the struggles we had early on when we were trying to figure out how to bring this stuff into shortwave and provide value is like, okay, if it can do anything, like where do we start? And we thought, you know, the first thing we should probably do is build something super general purpose that gives somebody the full breadth of what is possible, even if the UX isn't super polished for any particular use case, so we can get a better understanding of what people want to do. So the concept for us was similar to sort of ChatGPT of like, what if there was like a human sitting next to you in a chair, watching you do your email, who knew everything about what's on your screen, who knew everything about all the emails you had ever sent, received, who knew about your calendar, and could help you do stuff. And one of the reasons we had confidence that this would be a good idea is this is something that people already have. Like people have executive assistants that sit in their inbox and help them with their calendar and schedule things. And people pay a lot of money for this. And we thought, hey, if we can build something that does some small fraction of that reasonably well, this could be really valuable to people. And so we started with something very conversational, very general purpose. You can do it, you know, you could do all the normal stuff you do in ChatGPT with it, but you can also ask about your calendar, ask about your emails, have it do searches for you, have it write things for you, all of that kind of right from that sidebar. And we do intend over time to have like much more focused experiences for certain things. So I don't know if you play with the AI autocomplete feature, but that's one where we're like trying to optimize the UX, but we wanted to start general, figure out where the really common use cases were and then polish those experiences as we learn.
For starters, when I first sign up, I connect my Gmail. And is there support for any other client, or is it 100% you have to have a Gmail to start with it? Or could I start with I guess nobody's really starting from scratch really much, right? But could I just come and start a shortwave account with no other email client at all?
Not yet. It's Gmail only. We would love to have, you know, a hosted service that just, you know, we set up an account for you. We'd love to have it eventually be something that works for the Microsoft suite and something that's on-prem. That's all in the ambitions. But one of the things that just helped us move faster is the go-to-market of, I have an existing account, I sign in with my Google account, and boom, I have all of my email there, and I have all of my labels and contacts and everything. Like, that onboarding experience is really nice. And so that's really where we're focusing our RV1 here.
Hey, we'll continue our interview in a moment after a word from our sponsors. The Brave Search API brings affordable developer access to the Brave Search Index, an independent index of the web with over 20 billion web pages. So what makes the Brave Search Index stand out? One, it's entirely independent and built from scratch. That means no big tech biases or extortionate prices. Two, it's built on real page visits from actual humans, collected anonymously, of course, which filters out tons of junk data. And three, the index is refreshed with tens of millions of pages daily, so it always has accurate, up-to-date information. The Brave Search API can be used to assemble a dataset to train your AI models and help with retrieval augmentation at the time of inference, all while remaining affordable with developer-first pricing. Integrating the Brave Search API into your workflow translates to more ethical data sourcing and more human representative datasets. Try the Brave Search API for free for up to 2,000 queries per month at brave.com/API. OmniKey uses generative AI to enable you to launch hundreds of thousands of ad iterations that actually work, customized across all platforms with a click of a button. I believe in OmniKey so much that I invested in it, and I recommend you use it too. Use Cogrev to get a 10% discount.
Gotcha. Cool. So one of the first things that you do is import the email history. And, you know, as you mentioned, there's gigabytes sitting around for most people. Certainly I'm among them. I've given my email address out perhaps too freely over time. And so, you know, there's an unbelievable amount of content in there. Most of it not very valuable. And one of the big challenges is getting to the valuable stuff, given all that clutter. I'd love to hear, you know, more about that kind of data processing pipeline, because certainly as you're setting this up for later success, the importing of the data and any pre-processing of the data or any embedding of the data is like a pretty critical aspect of the whole thing. So what's happening in that first import phase?
So this is actually a place that we got kind of lucky in that, well, I mentioned when we first started the company, we were trying to build a collaborative email app. And if you want to make something collaborative, that means you want to like share data with other people. You probably want things to update in real time. And so the architecture you want to build for an app like that is something where there's, you know, both client and server working together, and there's real-time streams of data moving back and forth. And this was an architecture that we were very comfortable building, because this is how the Firebase products work. That's how we built it. And when we decided to focus on LLMs and integrating those, this turned out to be a really big win, because unlike basically all of our competitors, we have all of your emails on the server. So we did the heavy lifting of, we're going to import them when you sign up, which is, you know, very expensive for us to do, because we have to have copies of all that stuff and we have to re-index and everything. But we have that data now, which means things like embedding and storing the vector database, or having like access to a beefy cluster of GPUs to like run cross-coding models, is something that's really easy for us to do relative to other people that might have to start from scratch when doing that. So the moment you sign up, we start, you know, reverse chronologically going through and sucking your emails. And you can actually see that pop into your inbox as we're moving along. And we're taking those and we are, you know, saving off a copy of them in our database. And then we are indexing those both in Elastic so that we can do full text search, but then also we are embedding them with an open source model and throwing them into Pinecone, which is our vector database, for retrieval there. And that whole process can take, depending on the size of your inbox, you know, from, you know, a few minutes to a few days. It's not uncommon for someone to have, you know, 3, 4, 5 million emails in their inbox. So it's a big process. But once we have all that stuff indexed, we can do a bunch of cool stuff. We can do full text searches against it. We can do AI-based searches against it. So it's really powerful.
Can you comment a little bit on the choice of embedding model and also the choice of vector database? Pinecone, I don't know if they offer both a self-hosted version and a hosted version. But yeah, I'd love to. I mean, we have a lot of folks. Obviously, the whole world is implementing RAG stuff right now. So everybody wants to learn from your hard-won lessons in terms of the right models, the right infrastructure to use.
We actually, at this point, I think have decided that even though we just released this in October, it's all obsolete and we're gonna do a bunch of new stuff. But we chose to use an open source embedding model. It's called InstructorXL. It was on Hugging Face as our is an embedding model because it is cheap and fast and works well. And the vector is not too big. And we kind of did the math on, hey, you've got millions of emails and, you know, what is this going to cost? And with the way we wanted the infrastructure set up, the vector database was going to start to dominate in terms of cost. And so we didn't necessarily want the biggest, best model because we store a ton of emails. We don't necessarily query them super often. And there's trade-offs that you can make between the effort you spend embedding, the size of the embedding, the effort you spend doing the searches. So for example, with a smaller vector for your embedding model, you might not be as precise in your vector search. But what you can do is you can simply like return more results and shove more results into the prompt. So maybe the queries are a bit more expensive, but the embedding and the storage is cheaper. So you want to factor that all in. So yeah, we chose an open source embedding model that made the embedding cheap. We chose a sort of medium-sized vector to make the storage relatively cheap. We've chose Pinecone primarily for performance considerations. So it has a feature that none of the other kind of top tier vector databases has, which is namespacing, where we can, without a performance penalty, have a huge number of users on there together, and it makes it easy to manage that. Like we looked at, using pgvector and a bunch of these other things, and a Pinecone gave us the best option there.
And now how would that contrast? Because pgvector, I think, is obviously one that my guess is going to increasingly become a lot of people's first contact with vector databases just because they've already got the PG part of PG vector. And so, yeah, why not, right? How does that fall short? I'm imagining if I wanted to run a query, you can always do the like where user equals their ID and vector, but why does that not work as well?
It comes down to the implementation. So in PG vector, when you do a query like that, where you say, find me things that are semantically similar to blah, and then filter in these with these criteria, it's doing those in order. It's first going out and it's doing, k nearest neighbors, it's finding those, and then it's filtering by that other criteria. And if you have all of the different vectors from all of your different users jumbled together in the same table, you're going to have to sift through like a very large number of those vectors, and that can just slow things down. And there are workarounds here. So for example, like you could just make a lot of tables, which is something that I've talked to people who do this, but that comes with a lot of sort of headaches in terms of database management that we didn't necessarily want to take on. So I think if you're in the process right now of picking your vector database, you should think, how many namespaces do I need? Is it one per user? Is it one per company? Is it one global one? You should think hard about how many documents you have and how big those documents are. And I think for most people doing RAG, they're not working with as many as we are, right? Like for us, an email inbox could have millions of emails. I think a lot of the use cases people have for RAG, it's maybe, thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. So the right choice for you might be different. We did look at pgvector because we also have the pg part of that in our stack, and it would have been very convenient. But I think we made the right call in what we did here.
In terms of the size of the, and this maybe is one of the things that perhaps you're already thinking about evolving, but I know that OpenAI just released an update to their embedding product. And I haven't studied this in detail yet, but I understand that basically they have come up with a way to have variable length vectors and sort of do it such that if you use the small one, you're getting like the bulk of the information. They've kind of like, created varying sizes that, sort of apply like an 80-20 sort of principle where they're capturing most of the information in the smallest version, and then you get incrementally more, but it obviously, grows in size to capture that greater resolution. Do I have that right? And is that the kind of thing that you are thinking of moving to next?
That's my understanding. I think it's super smart because you don't necessarily want the biggest vector. You want to consider the trade-offs between, how many documents you have, how often you query these documents, how good you need those results to be, how fast you need those results to be. And there's a lot of different options for making this stuff work. So if I can get into architecture briefly for RAG, it's not just quite so simple as, you know, you ask a question and we go to the directory database. When we do our AI search, we're actually searching across our traditional search infrastructure using keywords and labels and time ranges. We sort of extract features and we do that. And then we're also looking at the vector database and we're taking all of those results and we're running them through another model for re-ranking. So we have a cross-encoding model that basically looks at the question you're asking in every document and says, how likely is this document to help answer the question? And because we have that cross-encoding model, we don't need the vector database to be super accurate, because what we can do is just overfetch. We can just cast a really wide net and say, give me a lot of nearest neighbors, and then run those through the cross-encoding model to actually like winnow that down to a smaller set. So in our case, we said, hey, you know, the trade-off there is basically performance, right? The more of these that we have to sift through with the cross-encoding model, the slower it'll be. And so we wanted to trade off basically latency at retrieval time against cost for storage and cost for embedding. And we tried to pick like a peak that made sense for us in that regard. But I think that peak is going to be different for different applications. So the idea that you're going to have that flexibility with embedding models going forward, I think is really key, really smart. One thing actually I want to add here, in the vector database world, I think one of the big changes that's going to come up here is people are going to start separating compute and storage so that right now, you know, most of the offerings that you have, that stuff's very tied together. And if you have something that has, you know, a lot of storage and a little bit of compute, or needs a lot of compute and a little bit of storage, you might not have a very good cross trade-off. But Pinecone just came out with a hosted service that we're looking at. And I think other people looking at this as well, of like, how do we make smarter cost trade-offs for people whose, you know, storage and reading and writing patterns might be different than other people?
Interesting. So down to the user level optimization of how you would manage their, is it managing their database or managing how you're accessing the database? I guess it could be both, right? But yeah, that's fascinating. Maybe we'll bump up one layer to the agent, to the AI assistant layer, and then we can still take a couple additional deep dives into the RAG side of it. So, you know, folks who listen to the Cognitive Revolution will certainly be familiar with the kind of basic scaffolding of an agent. You know, put a language model in a loop, give it a chance to kind of plan, give it a chance to, you know, think step by step, give it a chance to take some action, get some feedback. And okay, so we know that. You have essentially a version of that where when I type in a request to the AI assistant, and these can be like, find me something out of my email, or find and draft, or you know, even like find and check against my calendar for availability and draft. And you could suggest some more use cases there perhaps as well, but those are the kind of main go-to ones that I've been using.
Yeah, I was going to say the biggest ones are really search and things related to search, like find this information for me and synthesize it this way, and then writing, you know, help me write an email, which often also uses search to get the right context.
Yeah, I think it's cool on the search. I mean, there are so many times where I'm like, where did I have that? You know, I want a link. I know I put a link in an exchange with someone, but you know, I might have multiple threads with that person. I'm not exactly sure what my, you know, highlight what the like link text was when I put that in there. I have one of the great use cases, it's so simple, but it's just like so refreshing, is to just ask, can you find me the link to the whatever that I sent to whoever? And just have it pop back with that and be like, yep, that's the link. Amazing. Now I'm not like manually, you know, loading up all these screens and scanning through all the threads on my own. I find that in and of itself to be, you know, just an extremely great use case. I mean, maybe I have memory problems that other people don't suffer from, but for me, that's been really cool. And I like the writing as well. And I do want to get into more detail on kind of exactly how that works. But so I put in a query. It goes through this kind of pretty, you know, familiar, at least from a UI like presentation layer agent sort of loop. It'll say it's thinking, it'll say it's searching, it will potentially say it's, you know, going to cross-reference against the calendar, and then it can be drafting as well. Do you want to kind of unpack those steps a little bit? Like, for example, when searching, you know, notably, like I didn't give it keywords, so I imagine there's a translation step in the background. And again, I think people really are very eager to learn from your hard-won lesson. So no detail would be too much detail here.
The thing that people are most impressed about with our AI assistant is, frankly, that it just works at all. I think, you know, there's lots of people that are, you know, building demo AI agent systems, but there aren't very many that have actually plugged it all the way end-to-end together in like a real working product and made it valuable. And ours, I wouldn't say there's nothing that we're doing that I think is like revolutionary or groundbreaking. Like we're not, you know, AI researchers. We're, you know, we're software people, we're application developer people, but we have managed to duct tape together all the right components and hook it up with traditional infrastructure in a way that actually delivers a working product. And I think the one of the core insights that we had early on when building this was that we couldn't get planning to work for the quality of models that we were working with at the time. And I still think that's probably still true, where if you try to break it down into a series of steps where each step sort of feeds into the next step and each step does some piece of work, that there's going to be errors made by the models at each step that propagate through. And we weren't able to get the quality level where we wanted to be. So we changed it a little bit and we said, okay, what if the goal here was to end up with one prompt that had all of the information you need in context, right? There was never anything left out of that final prompt. Like you're trying to get one prompt that has all the right information and you answer the question in a single LLM call. And then all of the other interesting stuff you do is try to get really clever about how you figure out what things to put in that prompt. So that's the way to think about our architecture is we do a whole bunch of work to try to figure out what should go in the prompt. And then we make one call to GPT-4 at the end being like, here's everything you need to know. Give us the right answer. The work to figure out what goes to that prompt actually tends to look a lot more like the agent architecture that you might be thinking of. The first thing we do is we do this thing called tool selection, where we try to figure out what information is the user suggesting that we go get. And we just do this with a prompt, with an LLM call. But in that LLM call, we are including a lot of context about the world. So we're telling it, hey, this is the user you're helping. This is the time of day. This is the settings that they have. This is the thread that's currently on screen. Like this is like the subject in the first few paragraphs of it. This is the stuff that's selected in the inbox. Like we tell the LLM, this is the state. And the reason for that is you might be asking contextual questions that, you know, by themselves are not answerable, but in context makes sense. You might be like, the thread might be like the Super Bowl and you might be like, what time is the game? And we can figure out if we plug all this stuff together, you're talking about the Super Bowl, but just in the abstract, we can't. So the first thing we do is we do this thing called tool selection using this big prop that has all the state of the world, trying to figure out what you're asking. And that returns essentially an array of different data sources. And those data sources could be as simple as including the full text in the thread that's on screen. It could be including settings that you have. It could be including certain like extra custom prompt instructions. Like we have a special set of instructions whenever you're trying to get us to summarize things so that we give you good summaries. But it could also be pulling up historical emails. And that's probably where the most interesting stuff is like accessing your historical emails. And if we choose that tool, so you'll notice like sometimes when you ask questions, it gives you an answer pretty quickly. And sometimes when you ask questions, it like says searching and then it's a little bit slower. That's basically, those are the times when we decide, okay, they want us to do RAG. We're going to do RAG and pull that in. So if we've chosen to do RAG, which is like one of like six or seven tools that we have, the next step is what we call query reformulation.
Hi, listeners. This was obviously just the first portion of my conversation with Andrew. To hear the rest, which I highly recommend, as it really is a masterclass in AI application architecture in general and RAG apps in particular, you'll need to subscribe to the new Cognitive Revolution feed. To do that, simply visit cognitiverevolution.ai. That's cognitiverevolution.ai. And there you'll find buttons to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or your favorite podcasting app. You can also sign up for our newsletter for email updates. I realize that it is a bit annoying to end an episode midway like this, and I do apologize for that. But we really want to make sure that our listeners are subscribed to both feeds, each of which will have original content going forward. So take just a second to visit cognitiverevolution.ai, subscribe to the new feed, and hopefully we won't have to do this too many more times. I'll see you for the full conversation with Andrew Lee of Shortwave on the new feed. And for now, I thank you for being part of the Cognitive Revolution.
Hey all, Eric Torenberg here. I'm hearing more and more that founders want to get profitable and do more with less, especially with engineering. Listen, I love your 30-year-old ex-Fang senior software engineer as much as the next guy, but honestly, I can't afford them anymore. Founders everywhere are trying to turn to global talent, but boy, is it a hassle to do at scale, from sourcing to interviewing to on-the-ground operations and management. That's why I teamed up with Sean Lanahan, who's been building engineering teams in Vietnam at a very high level for over 5 years to help you access global engineering without the headache. Squad, Sean's new company, takes care of sourcing, legal compliance, and local HR for global talent so you don't have to. With teams across Asia and South America, we can cover you no matter which time zone you operate in. Their engineers follow your process and use your tools. They work with React, Next.js, or your favorite front-end frameworks. And on the back end, they're experts at Node, Python, Java, and anything under the sun. Full disclosure, it's going to cost more than the random person you found on Upwork that's doing 2 hours of work per week but billing you for 40. But you'll get premium quality at a fraction of the typical cost. Our engineers are vetted top 1% talent and actually working hard for you every day. Increase your velocity without amping up burn. Head to ChooseSquad.com and mention Turpentine to skip the waitlist. Turpentine is a network of podcasts, newsletters, and more covering tech, business, and culture, all from the perspective of industry insiders and experts. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from AI with Cognitive Revolution to Econ 102 with Noah Smith. Our other shows drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, and investors, like Moment of Zen and my show Upstream. We're looking for industry-leading hosts and shows along with sponsors. If you think that might be you or your company, email me at eric@turpentine.co. That's E-R-I-K @turpentine.co.